Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Welcome along to our deep dive today. We're heading into some really significant territory, looking at a landmark work from India, Balchandra Nemadz Kosala. That translates as cocoon. And this isn't just, you know, a novel. It's more like a foundational text for modern Marathi literature, a real cultural touchstone, and honestly, something of an act of rebellion when it first came out.
You've put that really well. When Kosala arrived, it genuinely sent shockwaves. People often compare it to Salinger's The Catcher in the Rye.
Right, I've heard that comparison.
Yeah, because it just tapped into something raw, that frustration, that deep alienation
felt
by, wow, a whole generation. So what we want to do today is really get under the skin of it, unpack the story, the characters' journeys, and dig into those themes that make it still feel so relevant, so revolutionary, even now.
Absolutely. And to really get Kosala, you first need to understand the person behind it, Balchandra Nemadz, and his philosophy. He was born back in 1938 in Maharashtra's Khandesh region. Mm. And he's really seen as the architect of this idea called Desivad, nativism, basically.
Right. Nativism.
And this isn't just about style, is it? It's a conscious rejection, a turning away from Western literary models, saying, no, let's look to our own traditions. India's native soil, the language, the rhythms, the actual lived realities.
Exactly. His essays, his critical work have shaped thinking for ages. And that uncompromising vision, it won him the John Pith Award in 2014, which is, you know, India's highest literary honor.
Yeah.
Hugely significant.
And you see this philosophy directly in his writing style.
Oh, completely.
Yeah.
It's the philosophy in action. It's raw. It's colloquial.
Mm-hmm.
He often goes off on these tangents, these digressions.
Which feels very conversational, actually.
It does. And he champions regional dialects. He wasn't afraid to use the language people actually spoke, challenging that more formal, sometimes slightly anglicized Marathi that was common in literature then.
And you have to think about the time, right? Post-independence India.
Exactly. The whole country was grappling with its identity, searching for an authentic voice in politics, in art, and definitely in literature. Nemadz with Kosala just delivered that voice, unfiltered, powerful.
It's interesting, too, how people talk about his philosophy. Some sources call it Desivad, focusing maybe more on rooting literary traditions in local soil.
Mm-hmm. Like the forms, the structures.
Right. Whereas others use Desiata, which seems to emphasize cultivating an authentic spirit, an indigenous way of expressing things, free from Western baggage.
So maybe a subtle difference. Desivad more about the how. Desiata more about the what or the essence.
Kind of. But both point firmly back to finding a truly Indian voice, shaking off that colonial influence that had lingered for so long.
And Kosala Cocoon was a perfect vehicle for this, published in 1963. Nemadz was only 25.
Just 25. Amazing.
It landed like a, well, like you said, a thunderclap.
Yeah.
It was just so different from the romantic, often idealistic novels that were popular then. Suddenly, here's this cynical, rambling anti-hero. Completely new.
It's fascinating, though, that while some call it his debut novel, written so young, other perspectives suggest it came during his mature period, like his vision was already fully formed.
Huh. Interesting distinction.
But either way, whether it was, you know, this early burst of genius or a more considered statement, it underlines the sheer impact and the depth of thought behind it from the get-go.
No question. It was a revolution. People call Kosala an anti-novel because it just throws out conventional plot structure.
Right. It's not linear at all.
No.
Yeah.
It's episodic, like reading someone's diary, just following the character's thoughts. It looks like a Bildungsroman, a coming-of-age story.
But it twists it completely.
Exactly. It subverts it.
Yeah.
Instead of maturing, finding his place, our protagonist, Pandurang, just retreats further and further into his own alienation, turns back on the whole idea.
And that's what made it so controversial, but also so incredibly popular, especially with younger people.
They saw themselves in it.
Absolutely. Their own frustrations, feeling out of step, disillusioned. That Catcher in the Rye comparison really holds up. It became this voice for a generation, a real cultural moment.
So let's get into the story itself. It's framed as this fictional autobiography of Pandurang Sangvikar.
Our narrator.
Our narrator, yeah. He comes from a pretty well-off rural family in Khandesh.
Yeah.
And the novel traces his life, childhood, up to age 25.
Mm.
And it's just this constant, often darkly funny struggle against a world he finds, well, absurd.
And the central irony, which is brilliant, is that Pandurang, having completely bombed out of college,
spectacularly failed.
Right. He decides the best thing to do is write a historical account of his own life, which by any normal standard is pretty unremarkable.
It's wonderful.
And this all plays out against that backdrop of newly independent India, caught between the old ways and this confusing, sometimes empty promise of modernity. You see that tension reflected in Pandurang himself, bouncing between the suffocating village and the equally hollow city life in Pune.
It's like Nimaid is subtly poking fun at how society wants these grand narratives.
Right.
And Pandurang's just saying, no, my failed life is the history that matters to me. It's a defiant claim of personal significance.
Yeah, it is.
And the real conflict, it's internal, too. It's his consciousness just fighting against the absurdity he sees everywhere. Family, religion, education, friendships, love. Nothing escapes his cynical eye.
So he's desperately looking for meaning, but kind of sabotaging himself.
Exactly. He almost embraces failure. It becomes his way of rebelling against all the expectations, especially from his very authoritarian father.
So the big question Nimaid throws at us is, how do you live authentically? How do you keep your integrity when the world feels fake?
And Pandurang Sangvikar is the embodiment of that question, the anti-hero in his cocoon. He's cynical, definitely self-absorbed, no doubt about it.
But witty, you have to give him that.
Oh, incredibly witty.
Yeah.
But also just profoundly alienated. He criticizes everything and everyone, himself included. His motivations are messy. He wants connection. You feel that sometimes.
But he pushes it away.
He does, through detachment, cynicism. But the main driving force, rebellion against his father. His father represents everything he hates. Materialism, blind tradition, authority that's never questioned.
And his journey, it's less about becoming something and more about unbecoming things.
That's a great way to put it, unbecoming.
He sheds all these identities society tries to stick on him. Good student, dutiful son, future landowner. Nope. We see him go from these vague hopes in the village to outright rebellion in Pune.
The Pune years are key.
Yeah, forming that gang of misfits, endless philosophical debates, that completely doomed scheme to help pavement dwellers.
Which just collapses into farce, right? The perfect symbol of his inability to actually do anything with his ideas.
Totally. And then the ultimate act, deliberately failing his exams.
Mm-hmm.
So by the end, he's back home, no job, no wife, no direction. But there's this strange acceptance in his cocoon, a sort of wary peace with meaninglessness. It's not a happy ending, but it's his ending.
It's like a retreat, but also maybe a kind of freedom, rejecting the whole game.
Exactly. It makes you wonder, is real freedom sometimes just disconnecting from what everyone else calls success?
Then there's the father, Jagannath Sangvikar. He's the old world personified, wealthy, powerful, pragmatic. Land and status, that's what matters.
And their relationship is the absolute core conflict, just
right.
A tragic, total failure to communicate, a huge gap.
Yeah. That quote about the two forts on opposite hills really nails it.
It does. And initially, Pandurang just sees him as this tyrant. But later, you get these hints. He starts seeing his father as maybe trapped, too. Trapped by the same system he upholds.
Not forgiveness, though.
No, not reconciliation. More like a sad flicker of understanding. Recognizing they're both kind of stuck just in different sides of the valley.
And amidst all this male angst, you have Mani, Pandurang's younger sister. She's like the quiet emotional center of the book.
Represents innocence, maybe,
yeah.
And duty.
Yeah, and the silent suffering, really, of women in that society. She's gentle, does what's expected, largely ignored by Pandurang and his navel gazing.
Until her death.
Exactly. Her death from smallpox is this huge turning point. It shatters Pandurang's cynical armor. He has to face this raw grief that his philosophies can't explain away.
It makes his own problems seem petty, maybe.
I think so. And it's also a subtle but powerful critique of how women were neglected, their vulnerability.
And the other characters. There's Suresh Bhatpat in college.
Ah, yes. The foil. Suresh is everything Pandurang isn't. Disciplined, ambitious, heading for conventional success. He's the path Pandurang rejects.
And the other Pune friends.
They're more like mirrors of Pandurang's own disillusionment. Aimless, drifting, partners in crime for pranks, endlessly talking. They capture that feeling of being adrift.
And the whole academic world itself becomes a kind of character, doesn't it?
It really does. The professors, the administrators,
mm-hmm.
You see all sorts. Some are genuine scholars. Others are just playing the power game, using their positions.
Mm-hmm.
As part of Nimaid's broader critique of institutions, how they can corrupt, especially education.
Okay, let's track the plot a bit more closely. It's episodic, like you said, starts with childhood in the village.
Mm-hmm. Where you see the roots of his rebellion against his father,
mm-hmm.
but also just kid stuff, innocence,
yeah,
mixed with that growing alienation and that crucial, ironic decision, I'm going to write my history.
Then the shift to Pune, that's the main chunk of the novel, and it's where the critique of city life and education really bites.
He goes looking for intellectual freedom.
And finds another prison, just different bars. He has that great line, something like, the university's motto should be, here we trade 4 years of youth for a degree.
Ouch.
Bubble on.
Brutal.
Eh.
But captures his feeling perfectly. It's just a transaction.
So the Pune years, the gang, the endless talk, the pranks, that scheme to help the poor that goes completely wrong.
The pavement dwellers thing, yeah. Such a painful metaphor for his inability to connect his ideas to reality. It just fizzles out.
And it all culminates in him deliberately failing his exams, the final up yours to the system.
Which leads, inevitably, to the humiliating return home. The prodigal failure.
And that's when the conflict with his father really erupts. All the resentment comes pouring out.
Followed by Mandiri's death, the emotional gut punch.
Right. Forces him to confront something real, something beyond his word games. It humbles him.
So the novel ends with Pandurang at 25, back in the village, in that cocoon. No neat solutions, no peace, really. Just this weary, stoic acceptance of absurdity.
His failure is his own, but there's a kind of integrity in that, isn't there? A melancholic dignity in staying true to who he is, however fractured.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Okay, let's really unpack the core themes now. The novel's heartbeat, if you like, its central nervous system.
Definitely. And right at the center, you have alienation and the existential quest. Pandurang is such a classic existential figure adrift, searching for an authentic way to live in a world that feels meaningless, even if that means being alone.
And linked to that, the scathing critique of modern education. He sees it as this hollow, colonial leftover. It rewards just fitting in, not thinking critically. His failure becomes almost a philosophical act.
Then there's that huge theme of tradition versus modernity and the generational conflict that comes with it, that gap between Pandurang and his father. Neither world seems to offer him a real home, does it?
No, he's caught between them, which leads to that constant pursuit of authenticity against hypocrisy. His cynicism, it's like a shield, isn't it?
Okay.
Against all the pretense he sees, family, college, society.
And his rebellion, even when it's self-destructive, it's basically him refusing to play the game, refusing to pretend.
Which makes it a subversion of the hero's journey, the anti-buildings Roman. He doesn't grow up, he grows away. He disintegrates, retreats.
And then it seems to suggest that maybe that's the only sane response sometimes, refusing to conform in a world that feels sick.
The book also really digs into moral compromise and integrity. It shows how easily those little ethical slips happen, how they add up. Integrity isn't something you just get. It's this constant, difficult struggle.
And don't forget, gender relations and power dynamics. It's subtle, but through Mattoni, through his mother, you see the constraints on women, the patriarchal structure. It adds another layer, challenging Pandurang's very male perspective.
Yeah, that's a really important point. And finally, that challenging theme of intellectual life and moral responsibility. Does being smart make you morally better? Or does it just give you fancier ways to justify your own failings? Nemed doesn't give easy answers there.
Not at all.
But what makes Kusala truly revolutionary, I think, isn't just the themes, it's how Nemed tells the story. His style, his technique, he intentionally smashes conventions. That's where the real power lies.
Oh, absolutely. The narrative itself, Pinarang's fictional autobiography, it's intensely personal, subjective.
Yeah.
And you can't always trust him, can you?
Definitely not. He's an unreliable narrator.
But his voice.
Yeah.
It's magnetic, funny, sharp, painfully self-aware. It just pulls you right into his head.
And that narrative perspective is clever. It feels like first person. You're right there with him. But some analysis suggests it's actually a tight third-person limited view.
Which gives that intimacy.
Exactly. You're psychologically close. But it also lets Nemamed subtly show you things Pandurang maybe doesn't see himself, adds layers.
And the structure, the anti-novel structure, fragmented, episodic, wandering off, it perfectly mirrors his messy thoughts, his chaotic inner life. It makes you feel his disorientation.
Plus, those stream of consciousness bits during moments of crisis
plunges you right in.
And the language, that's crucial. Nemed mixing standard Marathi with the Khandeshi dialect, that was radical.
Huge challenge to the establishment.
It gives Pandurang's voice this incredible earthy authenticity, makes him feel absolutely real, tied to his place.
And the irony running through it all. Pandurang writing his history of failure. It's funny, but also deeply sad. Satire and humor are his weapons against absurdity.
You see it in the symbolism too, the cocoon itself. It's isolation, yes, protection maybe, but also stagnation, arrested development.
Complex. And the historical record is his attempt to control the narrative, right? To find himself when he feels powerless. And the colleges, the institutions, stand for those bigger, often corrupt power structures.
Even the dialogue is doing heavy lifting. It's not just talk. It reveals psychology, social dynamics, often full of things left unsaid.
So much subtext.
It's amazing how Nimeid packs so much meaning into specific lines. They really stick with you. Let's pull out a few key quotes.
Okay. First up, right near the start. I have decided to write the history of my own life. Because what is history, after all, but a record of significant events? And to me, my own life is the most significant event of all. Sets up that irony perfectly, but also that universal human need to feel like your life matters, doesn't it?
It really does. Then there's that devastating one about his father. My father and I are like two forts on opposite hills. We can see each other clearly, we can even bombard each other, but we can never cross the valley in between. Just perfectly captures that unbridgeable gap, the tragedy of their non-communication, the whole generational divide in one image.
So powerful. And after Manny dies, this raw realization, after my sister Manny died, I realized that all my big ideas and philosophies were useless. Grief is a stone. You cannot argue with it. You can only carry it. That's him hitting rock bottom, emotionally.
Yeah.
His intellect is useless against that kind of pain. It's incredibly humbling.
Yeah. And digging a bit deeper, there's this thought. The price of knowledge is often the loss of innocence. But wisdom comes only to those willing to pay that price again and again. That speaks to the struggle for real wisdom, not just facts. It's painful. It involves confronting hard truths, losing illusions, again and again.
And finally, this reflection on choices. We create ourselves through our choices, but we also become prisoners of those creations. It highlights our power to shape ourselves, but also how those choices then limit us, trap us sometimes, the weight of the past.
So when you put it all together, the emotional impact of Kosala is really complex, isn't it? You laugh at Pandurang, you get frustrated with him, but there's this lingering sadness too.
Absolutely. And for many readers, especially young ones, there's this huge sense of validation. Finally, someone giving voice to that feeling of being out of step, frustrated with authority. His rebellion, even when it fails, feels liberating. It says it's okay to question.
And it leaves you thinking about morality not as some final destination, but as this messy, ongoing struggle. It doesn't wrap things up neatly. It makes you question your own ethics.
And Nimeid's compassion, even for Pandurang's flaws, is remarkable. He understands the pressures, the reasons for compromise, even if he doesn't excuse it. It's a very human look at weakness.
Ultimately, Kosala really messes with your ideas of success and failure. Pandurang fails by society's standards, completely. But he finds this weird, difficult integrity in doing so. It makes you think, maybe real failure is succeeding by becoming someone you're not.
That's a powerful thought.
So it really pushes us to ask, what does this novel teach us about finding ourselves, holding on to ourselves, when the world is constantly trying to mold us?
I think Kosala's enduring power is right there in its fearless authenticity. It makes us look at our own lives, our own compromises, and the sheer courage it takes just to be true to yourself, flaws and all.
And its honest look at human struggle, the funny bits, the tragic bits that just resonates across time, across cultures. It feels deeply, universally human. This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Katra Foundation.